Stay tuned for Cinema Clash with Charlie and Hannah, featuring two film critics with distinctly different tastes in movies, Charlie Jewell of CharlieJewell.com and Hannah Buchdahl of ChickFlix.net. He thinks her tastes are shallow. She thinks his are pretentious. Listen in as they discuss and debate new releases and other film-related topics. Let the clash begin.
Hello and welcome to the new and improved Cinema Clash. I am Charlie Jewell of CharlieJewell.com.
And I'm Hannah Buchdahl of ChickFlix.net.
There's two reasons, Hannah, why I think we are new and improved.
Mm-hmm.
One, we're on iTunes.
Woohoo!
You can go to iTunes, search Cinema Clash, and boom, we should be the first one that pops up.
And subscribe.
And we have business cards.
Yes.
That's like so official.
Isn't it? It's really kind of cool.
It's a little off today, though. We're not recording this at our normal time. We usually record this on Friday evening. Kids put to bed. It's not too late. Feeling good after the week. This is Thursday afternoon. Therefore, what is our Thursday afternoon drink?
Well, it's not beer, but it's close. I went with root beer. And not only is it root beer, but it's called Dang. And actually, it says, dang, that's good. It is actually pretty good.
It is good, even though right in the small print at the bottom says gluten-free, caffeine-free.
Yeah, well, so
is this still root beer?
You know, I know. But the idea is that, you know, it's like, dang, Charlie, you were really wrong about Wonder Woman. And, you can sort of substitute it for, like, lordy. You know, like, lordy, Charlie, well, that's good. Or I sure hope there are tapes.
I already know there's two of them that... We are just against, I believe that we're just against the mainstream. We'll get to that. This is a very busy, condensed episode. We have 7 films to talk about. I've seen 6. I believe you've seen 5. 7. There's a lot going on. The big one, you didn't see.
I know.
I have to cover Tom Cruise and the Mummy all by myself.
I know, but I had an opportunity to go see Al Franken at a book signing, and...
Was it worth it?
It was worth it. He was very entertaining, and so...
You're name dropping on me, so I gotta say, the reason we're not... podcasting tomorrow night is because I'm going to see Paul Simon.
Oh, well, there you go. See, life interrupt us, so you know it happens.
All right, so Universal Pictures. They started really the whole monster thing off back in the early 30s. 1931, Dracula, Frankenstein. Next year, The Mummy. Next year, The Invisible Man. Like, it's these creations are theirs. They started it. And then they noticed, Disney Marvel is making all this money by the solo films, Iron Man, Thor, put them all together, The Avengers. They're killing it. Then they see Warner Brothers. And the DC Comics spinoffs, Superman, Batman, put them all together, Justice League. So, like, we are being left out in the cold with, like, Paramount. And we don't want to be stuck with Paramount. So, they invented something called Dark Universe. A couple years ago, they tried it with Dracula Untold. I didn't see it. I don't think anybody else did either.
I didn't see it.
So they're going to reboot it. We're going to start Dark Universe again with The Mummy. Starring Tom Cruise, who wakes up the mummy and then spends 2 hours trying to put her back in the box. Kind of a standard mummy thing. And I think it's too soon to reboot The Mummy. I was in college, I guess, when Brendan Fraser and Rachel Weisz were battling The Mummy in a handful of films. I think I stopped with when The Rock became the Scorpion King in 2002. That was not my deal. So comparing, a lot of people are just going to compare and contrast the two. I'm a Brendan Fraser version fan. The new Mummy stinks. It's not good. Dark Universe, you are in trouble because the world agrees with me. It's 21%.
Wow.
On the tomato meter. 21%.
Yeah, I did see the first one with Brendan Fraser, and I remember really liking Brendan Fraser in that role. I don't think I happened to catch anything beyond that one, but I do feel like it's not as soon as, for instance, all those Spider-Man reboots that we got, but I do think that Spider-Man, those reboots have worked out a lot better. This one I just have no interest in trying to catch up on, even though I am, in essence, I like Tom Cruise still. I don't like him on his personal stuff has gotten in the way of a lot of people enjoying his films and going to see his films. I think his bankability has dropped, but I still think he's a good actor. I can still see him doing well in this role. I just don't see a reason for this movie right now.
Tom Cruise in the Mission Impossible franchise is still way high up on my meter. That franchise, even though it's been 5 films now, and I think they're currently filming the 6th, is still strong, still fresh. They reinvent themselves every film, and I like them. He's really good as Ethan Hunt.
Mm-hmm.
Here he plays an Army long-range recon scout, Nick Morton, I believe his name is. And He's like, he reminded me of George Clooney from Three Kings. He's a war profiteer. He's in Mosul, Iraq. Probably a place on earth you don't want to be right now is in Mosul, Iraq. He goes into this village crawling with ISIS. And of course they have to fight, call on airstrike, blah, blah, blah. And that's when they accidentally find a sarcophagus that deliberately, you look at this thing and you can see whoever buried it 5,000 years ago is still warning you today, do not dig this up. All the visual signs are here. Do not take this sarcophagus out of the ground. Of course, they take it out of the ground, put it on the plane. And apparently, since I don't watch previews, that's the only thing they advertise this movie about is the plane stunt. Which is, it's impressive. So this is directed by a man named Alex Kurtzman, and it's funny that you brought up Spider-Man. He is the writer-producer behind all the recent reboots. Star Trek, that was Alex Kurtzman. The Amazing Spider-Man with Andrew Garfield, that was him. He wrote two of the Transformers, movies when Shia LaBeouf was still in there. And now he is rebooting The Mummy. It's his second time directing. He looks like he directed a small indie in 2012 starring Chris Pine called People Like Us. I don't remember ever seeing that.
Rings a bell. I think I did see it.
So I want to talk about the women real quickly in the film. So he's got no moral compass, no conscience. So the conscience in the film is the blonde, the love interest. She's played by Annabelle Wallace. We just saw her a couple weeks ago in King Arthur, Legend of the Sword.
Oh, I missed that one.
Oh, really? I was not impressed with her one bit. Her character's just written poorly, and she's always wrong place, wrong time, damsel in distress. Just an annoying character. But I love the mummy. Sophia Boutella. She was the chick with swords on her legs in Kingsman, the Secret Service. She was the funky-looking alien in Star Trek Beyond, the one who was all black and white in the face.
Oh, yeah.
So she's really good here as the mummy and very mad. Like, she's been in a bad place for 5,000 years. She murdered her father, murdered her infant brother, because she wanted to become, you know, the living god, Pharaoh of Egypt, and they didn't give her that chance. So murder spree, got interrupted, buried horrifically 5,000 years later. She's got some revenge on her mind. Russell Crowe.
Oh.
Shows up as Dr. Henry Jekyll. Henry Jekyll. And yes, it is that guy.
It is that Jekyll.
He's there for whatever reason. You know, it sounds like they were trying to hint at the next film, maybe.
Were they hiding something?
Ah, you might see that one as well. Hyde might make an appearance. But he's just a throwaway character. In fact, the film is just a throwaway film. It's not impressive. It drags. Don't go see The Mummy.
That's disappointing.
Yeah, it is disappointing. I like Tom Cruise. I wish it was good.
Well, I'll wait for Edge of Tomorrow 2.
That was a damn good movie.
That was.
Now, our second movie, we differ. I mean, I think we're on the same page. We differ from the rest of humanity.
80% of humanity, I guess.
It's billed as a horror film. It's marketed as a horror film. It's not a horror film. It's during apocalyptic. It's not post-apocalyptic. It's during apocalyptic, like, suspense thriller. It's called It Comes at Night. My initial problem with it is, I don't know what it is. I have no idea what it is, but it comes at night.
Yes, and I, after 97 minutes, I still don't know what it was.
The father, he will stop at nothing to protect his wife and son from whatever it is. It's a malevolent, mysterious presence terrorizing them way out in the woods. Apparently, it's taken over the whole world. And they're somewhat isolated from it in their rural, awesome cabin. Like, it's a nice house. And it's a pathogen, I guess. It's a disease. You get this disease, you're going to die. And it's by a man named Trey Edward Schultz. His second film, because his first film was Creature, which I put on my top 10 list
last year because I love Creature so much. I didn't love Creature either.
But it sounds like you're feeling the same way as I am on It Comes at Night.
Yeah, I mean, but I did feel that a bunch of the people around us at our screening were all in the same mindset of, WTF, what did we just see? So even though Rotten Tomatoes has given it, it's up there in like the 80% range.
89.
It's crazy because I don't understand why anybody would have really enjoyed this movie. You go along with it in a typical horror movie kind of fashion. It sort of tries to be, I think, a little bit like a 10 Cloverfield Lane where you don't quite know where it's going and you've got you've got these people who are just confined to a house and trying to figure out what's going on outside the house and the world there. But to me, I didn't care. I really just didn't care what it was. And the longer the movie went on and the more it really wasn't explained, I didn't get it. I didn't know why we should get invested in these people. And it just, there's nothing entertaining at all about it, even at the end. Sometimes, you know, it wraps up in a way that's thought-provoking in an interesting, entertaining sort of way. I just felt that I had lost, you know, an hour and a half of my life. And so I think they even said on the movie poster, maybe like, imagine the end of the world. Now imagine something worse. What? And to me, it's this movie.
Oh, that's really good.
So
apparently, everyone's saying it's not about it. It's not about whatever it is. It's about how people treat people during the apocalypse. Our first family is, they're survivalist. And then they get introduced to another family. They take them in, and you can see it's at some risk. They don't know this other family. Are they just trying to escape? Are they up to no good? And so Trey Edward Schultz got to play with real actors this time. Krisha, he cast his family. He had no money. This time he gets Joel Edgerton.
Yeah.
As the father, the overprotective, follow-my-rules father. Carmen Ejogo is his wife. And the new parents who come in are Christopher Abbott, who was great in James White last year, or was it 2 years ago, and Riley Keough. Here's your trivia question. See if you know this, if you saw this. Riley Keough has a very famous grandparent.
No.
Who is that?
I don't know. Is it the same last name?
Nope.
I didn't think so.
She does not share the same last name as Elvis Presley.
Oh, you're kidding. Is that Lisa Marie's daughter?
I don't know.
No, but Riley?
I have no idea.
I mean, who else could it be?
I don't know. Did Elvis have two kids?
No, he just had Lisa Marie.
Well, there you go.
And so this has to be Lisa Marie's daughter.
Riley Keough was Elvis's granddaughter.
Wow.
So it's not as tight as 10 Cloverfield Lane. They're not in a bunker. They can go outside. They wear gas masks and everything to go outside. And you can hear my kid upstairs. And I just felt cheated.
Yeah, I did too. I think that was the problem, is I felt there was no payoff. And you stay in it hoping that there's a payoff, that there's a reason that you're enduring this kind of stuff. And it is tense. And I mean, Joel Edgerton, it's really fascinating to see him in this role after seeing him in Loving. It's a very different look for him.
He was so quiet in Loving.
Yeah, he was so quiet in this one. He has definitely more opportunity to have a much broader set of emotions on display. So I liked him. The acting was good, but I just, again, I don't know why anybody would choose to endure this particular movie. So, I mean, I guess there's horror fans out there who maybe will flock to it, but I certainly would say, you know, you should see Get Out first if you're looking for that.
I heard someone comparing this as, like, this is the second big horror movie of the year.
Yeah.
Was it Travis? Was it Travis Hobson who said that? And he said, this and Get Out. And it's like, do not even compare this to Get Out.
Exactly. Because Get Out was a surprise for me. I liked it, and I don't typically like the genre. And so I can't put them in the same ballpark at all.
All right. Our next film I didn't see. You took it solo. It's called Megan Levy. Tell me about Megan Levy.
Megan Levy's about a Marine and her dog. So it's based on a true story. And I went to a screening, and it turns out, you know, somehow they didn't let everyone know that this screening was going to have the director, a Q&A with the director afterwards. And Chuck Schumer, the senator from New York, showed up to introduce the film.
The Senate Minority Leader.
Yes. And unfortunately, the movie theater was at least half empty, and since we didn't know there was going to be a Q&A, most of us left because we just were not prepared to be staying that late. But Chuck Schumer introduced it because his office was instrumental in the true story about this Marine who went off to Iraq. She was deployed with this German Shepherd named Rex, who was a bomb-sniffing dog. And so they went to Iraq to sniff out IEDs before, you know, anyone would come upon them, hopefully. And they get wounded. And so when she comes back stateside, she is hoping to adopt Rex. But Rex has had some temperamental issues.
PTSD.
some PTSD, and he's deemed unadoptable, which pisses her off. and he gets sent back for, he gets redeployed. She, in the meantime, goes back to civilian life, and she spends the next few years actually trying to lobby the military to let her adopt Rex. And Schumer's office, you know, ultimately intervened, and it's just basically what Schumer said was that he, his office just expedited the adoption. So it's meant to be this feel-good movie, but at some points it tries to be too many things. It's a war movie, it's a love story, it's a dog movie, it's got it stars Kate Mara, who's Rooney Mara's sister.
No way. And they are sisters? No, I'm not kidding. Like,
yes,
everyone knows Kate Mara from season one of House of Cards.
Oh my gosh.
I did not know they were sisters.
How could you not know they were sisters?
I didn't know they were sisters. I had no idea.
Oh my goodness. Anyway, so I'm glad I taught you something.
That is
ridiculous. Wow. So Kate Mara from House, that people would know from House of Cards. She's a very good actress. She plays Megan Levy. And it's it just feels all the way through like one of those pet projects. You know, somebody went, oh my gosh, what a great story, and this needs to be turned into a movie. And I think they got some star power in it because it was just one of those things where somebody just decided that they wanted to be involved more as a labor of love kind of thing. They've got Bradley Whitford and Edie Falco to play her parents. So, but their roles are completely underwritten, underdeveloped. And so it was a waste of their talent.
Second time this year for Bradley Whitford playing a dad.
But yes, but he played a much better dad in Get Out. and so it drifts into cliche territory in so many ways. I think when they're out on these missions in Iraq, they're trying to give you that sense. It's like the Hurt Locker kind of tension with, oh my gosh, is this thing going to blow up while they're out there trying to dismantle an explosive. But then there's like the troubles on the home front with her parents being divorced and her having, trying to overcome a tragedy in her life and being a bit of a drifter and not knowing what she wanted to do with her life, which is why she joined the Marines to begin with, in 2003. So 9/11, I think, was probably one of the main triggers for her joining. And, but then it has Rapper Common as a drill sergeant.
Oh, that,
attempting to channel Louis Gossett Jr.,
mayonnaise.
An officer and a gentleman. And attempting being the key word here, because it just felt so mimicking to me that it took me out of the moment. I just thought it was a little over the top. So this is, yeah, this is one of those things where I would suggest you look at the website History versus Hollywood to really get that chart of here's the true story in reality. Here is the here's what Hollywood did in terms of using creative license. And I think if you just want a general kind of feel good story that feels more like a TV movie, then you'll be okay with this, but it's not a must see. I think it's a good airplane movie.
I think I'd rather see The Hurt Locker again.
Yeah. And, you know, it was actually directed by Gabriella Cowperthwaite, who is best known and really only known for Blackfish, for the documentary about the killer whales.
Didn't that win it? Was that nominated for an Oscar? It won the WAFCA Best Documentary.
It might have even won the Oscar.
It won the Oscar, too. But that was a tough documentary.
It was a tough documentary. And so my thinking was, well, maybe the original intent was to do this as a documentary, but there wasn't really, it didn't have the raw materials that you would need to make it into a really good documentary. And then when I read the real story versus the Hollywood version, you realize that they had to do a lot to interject some drama and some characterizations in this movie version that maybe wouldn't necessarily have tracked in real life. And so it gets stuck between trying to be true enough to the story so that they didn't go over, you know, too far in the other direction with the creative license, but by not going all, you know, in the other direction a little deeper, you end up with what I think is a pretty superficial movie.
Well, our next film is about as far away from Iraq as you can get. It's a period piece. It's British period drama. I'm thinking 19th century England. And it's adapted from a novel by Daphne du Maurier. And apparently it's one that Hitchcock didn't get around to making, because remember, he did du Maurier's Rebecca in 1940, which I think won Best Picture. And he also did The Birds, Daphne du Maurier did the birds.
Didn't this one get made in the 1950s?
It's remade. I don't know if Hitchcock made that.
Oh, yeah, I don't either.
So my cousin Rachel. Rachel, by the way, is played by Rachel Weisz. Good casting there. So a young Englishman, we'll call him Philip, played by Mr. Sam Claflin. He's plotting revenge against a mysterious, beautiful cousin. They're like first or second cousins. Believing she murdered...
Hopefully second.
His buddy, his guardian. The guy, Philip was an orphan, and his other cousin, Ambrose, took him into his homestead and raised him up, and they were like best friends. Ambrose looks like he gets tuberculosis, goes to Florence, Italy, meets his cousin Rachel. They fall in love, get married, and Philip starts getting these letters from Ambrose like, hey, cuz, something's wrong with Rachel. Like, she's really mean, and she makes me this tea. She might be poisoning my tea, and I'm dying. Come and help me. By the time he gets to Italy, Ambrose is dead, and Rachel's disappeared. She's gone. Oh, so he's on the warpath. Goes back home to England, and who should drop by? Rachel. Philip doesn't have a chance. He finds himself complicated. He falls under, maybe you would call it, a beguiling spell.
He's enamored with Rachel's beauty and charm, much
she's
more than
way
he
older than him. She's probably 15, 20 years older than him.
Although she's supposed to be, but I didn't feel that until it became a plot point much later on.
And it felt Hitchcockian. Like, it is painting Rachel as nefarious, up to no good. There's something wrong with this woman. It's directed by a man named Roger Mitchell. Do you know who Roger Mitchell is? Did you look at his filmography? Would you
no,
be surprised to know that in 1999 he directed a little British film called Notting Hill?
I love Notting Hill. This is no Notting Hill.
This reminded me, it's not the same temperament. It reminded me of 2 years ago, Far From the Madding Crowd. They're on this estate. They have their workers, you know, working the fields and the barn. And, oh, Hannah, I was suffering through this film. It was so boring.
It was boring. It was just plain old boring. I liked Far From the Madding Crowd for the most part. So so that one, to me, held my interest a little more. This one, I'll tell you, if Sam Claflin weren't so cute, then this movie would not have worked at all. Some people might know him from the chick flick sob story, Me Before You.
He was the wheelchair guy.
He was the guy in the wheelchair. And
he was Finnick.
So he...
from The Hunger Games.
Oh, that's right.
He was a trident guy.
Yeah. So so this is, you know, a chance for him to really dominate the screen. And he's good. That's just another one of these movies where the acting is good. I don't fault anything with the acting, but boy, it dragged. It just dragged.
Because it's not written well. The adaptation fails. They just the same scenes over and over again.
Exactly. That's what I noted too. Was that they kept hitting these same plot points. Like, she's serving him this tea. And you're like, why in the world would you drink this tea? Like, don't drink the tea. And so it was a little ridiculous, because then if he survived drinking the tea once, you're like, will he survive it the next time? I don't know. And it felt like a retread of just other things that you've seen before. And it just, I thought about it, to its credit, though, I did think a little bit more about it afterwards in terms of the ending. I felt was left open to interpretation.
Well,
our friend Eileen did not feel that way, who was sitting, I think, between us at that particular screening. Eileen thought, she's a bad egg. Boom. End of story. Well, but I'm just saying. So
Eileen is incorrect.
Eileen is incorrect.
the ending is a twist.
Exactly. So the fact that the ending is a twist, I saw the ending as a twist. You saw the ending as a twist.
Absolutely.
She did not see the ending as a twist. And I think that that helped salvage it a little bit, because I thought about it a tad more afterwards than I otherwise might have. But this is one of those movies where it was like the third one that week where I came out of the screening, the marketing folks asked me what I thought about it, and my response was, can I go see Wonder Woman again? And they said, that's what you said last night, and that's what you said the night before. And I said, that's because I have not seen, none of these movies are grabbing me in any way that I feel like I could say anyone should go to any of these if they have not already seen some of the other things that are already out there.
Unless you're talking about our next film, which does not stink. We had to watch it at home. It wasn't screened in a theater, but...
Oh, yeah.
Oh, thank goodness for the breath of fresh air that is Band-Aid. It premiered at this year's Sundance. Writer-director Zoe Lister-Jones. This is her first directorial effort. She's actually more of a TV actress. Apparently she has recurring roles on New Girl and Life in Pieces. She has written a couple, Anna and Ben. I think they're upper millennials, maybe the tail end of Gen X, or the oldest millennials.
Yeah.
And they can't stop fighting. They bicker about everything, mostly about the dishes. But that's really covering up for the fact that their career's at a standstill, and they're just not happy. And they embark on a last-ditch effort to save their marriage. They turn their fights into songs, and they start a band with Fred Armisen. And of course, Fred Armisen is the drummer. When I saw him, I just smiled. It's like, yes, this is Fred Armisen's role. I smiled during this movie. I just had so much fun watching it. Did you feel the same way?
Probably not quite as much as you did, but certainly compared to everything else we saw, it was a bit of a breath of fresh air. It is a quirky indie. It falls into that category with, it's rooted in reality and humor and heart, and it's very witty. I appreciated that it was very witty. You feel it's raw. You feel like you're sort of in the room with this couple as they're bickering over him leaving the dishes in the sink and the fact that, you know, her Armageddon suitcase contains Bed Bath & Beyond coupons, which, you know.
That'll be currency when it goes
it
down.
It will, exactly. So there are moments like that I think everybody could really relate to certain aspects of this film. And, you know, Fred Armisen, when you've got him, he plays the neighbor who is not just a drummer, but he's a recovering sex addict. And he's living with these two hot chicks who are also recovering sex addicts. And you're just like, it's just one of those bizarro type of movies where you just sort of buy into it and enjoy it. But it also is rooted in some real heart. And they're trying to overcome a personal tragedy and find their way back. And what was interesting to me is there are times in this movie where you're rooting for them to split up. And then other times where you suddenly are like, you're kind of rooting for them to make it work and to find their way back. And they're attempting to find their way back through their shared love of music and a lot of pot smoking.
Yeah, it's somewhat of a tale of two halves. The first half is the comedy. Mm-hmm. The songs they create just, they make it seem like it's off the top of their heads. Some rock, some folk, some punk. They're good songs. I was laughing along with those songs. And the second half is where the drama comes in. They kind of go their separate ways and they have to heal separately. Ben goes back to see his mother, who all of a sudden just says, oh, let me tell you all about women. And now he's like, oh, okay, I know all about women now.
Yeah, that was a huge mistake, actually. If I had to pick one area of this movie that it just sort of lost its way, it was by attempting to just sort of use this one scene to explain away a whole bunch of things and to create this character turn. And so I thought that was a little contrived.
And this movie reminded me of, I think it was 2012, Celeste and Jesse Forever,
mm-hmm.
Adam Sandberg and Rashida Jones.
Yeah.
Has that sort of vibe. It's not as good as that movie, but right. I needed Band-Aid this week to clear up the on-running just garbage that I just film after film. It's like, what? Maybe it's me. Maybe I'm just tired of watching movies this week because I'm not connecting with any of these. And it's like, nope, I still exist because Band-Aid was able to break through the armor.
So. Yeah, it's got some mature themes. It's definitely for adults. They use the F word a lot. There's a lot of pot smoking. It really tries to explore these differences between the way men and women react to situations and how they process information and handle grief. And it does so in an occasionally heartbreaking but hopeful sort of way. And so I did like it. It's a quirky indie that kind of rises to that next little level, because usually, you know, very often these movies will bore me. But I agree with you that this one was just a nice break from the types of stuff we've been bombarded with. I still think Wonder Woman is way better, but...
How can you compare Band-Aid to Wonder Woman?
Because how could you give God of War a higher rating than Wonder Woman.
They're both war movies, Hannah.
If you can give the Chinese war movie, you know, a higher rating than Wonder Woman last week, then I'm okay.
I'm giving Band-Aid a higher rating than Wonder Woman.
Dang, Charlie, to quote the root beer sticker here. I think you're still a little off base on that. I think the box office will bear me out.
Box office does not mean good film. I know. What if The Mummy wins this weekend? Is it better than Wonder Woman all of a sudden?
The Mummy will not do better than Wonder Woman. I'm willing to bet you a case of dang root beer on on whether The Mummy will beat Wonder Woman. I am saying, it's a bet.
Because Tom Cruise is popular.
Tom Cruise is not as popular as he used to be, and I think that the buzz on this movie will diminish the impact somewhat. In the same way that the buzz on Wonder Woman lifted it above expectations, I think the negative buzz on The Mummy will keep it from, we'll see. It'll be interesting to see if The Mummy does as well as Pirates of the Caribbean.
Sometimes buzz doesn't affect blockbusters. Because the Transformers films still make money.
And Pirates of the Caribbean. Why anyone went to see that movie, yet it made like 60-some-odd million dollars in its opening weekend, so...
$47 million less than Wonder Woman.
Well, so exactly. So I am hoping that holds true, that somehow it would be awesome if Wonder Woman could beat The Mummy in its second week, if it could beat the opening weekend of The Mummy. I don't know if that's possible, but it would be really nice.
Well, our next film's a documentary, and it's not its fault. It's subjective. It hit me through a prism, because I don't know, 3 weeks ago, I saw a movie made by Werner Herzog starring Nicole Kidman as Gertrude Bell, the lady who drew the lines on the map and created Iraq, Syria, and created all the problems now in the Middle East due to geographical borders. Well, this documentary is called Letters from Baghdad, and it's about Gertrude Bell. I'm Gertrude Belled.
Belled out. The bell has rung.
She shaped the destiny of the Middle East after World War I, and the only reason anyone knows her name is because she was a woman. If it's a guy that did it, no one would really, care. So, and it's amazing. That's crazy that she was, this female was so powerful back in 1918, and her actions still reverberate today. I like Letters from Baghdad better than I did Queen of the Desert, which was the fictionalized version. And I'll tell you why. It's because they have actors and actresses acting out real people, and all the dialogue, everything spoken, is taken directly from, quoted from a letter or an account that someone had written about meeting Gertrude. And Gertrude's narrated by Tilda Swinton. So, of course I was bored, because I already knew everything about Gertrude Bell's life. I don't want to see it twice. So if you haven't seen any of them, and I don't think you have, because no one saw Queen of the Desert, and you want to learn about Gertrude Bell, then Letters from Baghdad's for you.
See, I don't think Letters from Baghdad works for anyone who doesn't already have a base of knowledge of who Gertrude Bell was. I did not feel that it helped develop or explain her character, who she was in real life at all. And so if I had not seen Queen of the Desert starring Nicole Kidman, it was more than 3 weeks. It was probably well over a month ago. But if I had not seen that film, then this one would have made even less sense to me. And so I feel they sort of complement each other. So if you saw Queen of the Desert and would like to know more about Gertrude Bell.
Oh, Lord, and who hear are you more, out there in the audience?
I don't know if you're out there. Or maybe if you read her biography, then this book, documentary will make sense to you. But I think if you're coming at it, let's say it was on PBS and you just flipped it on, you would turn it off really quickly.
Of course I would.
Because it's like, this is not your Ken Burns reading letters from the Civil War kind of treatment. This is boring. And so while you can appreciate the letters themselves and her, it's the lost art of letter writing, the rest of the film.
Their letters are good. They're well
written. Her letters are extremely well written. And it is amazing what she was able to accomplish. Especially when near the end, you discover she died at like 50, just before her 58th birthday. And so this woman really accomplished a whole lot in her 20s and 30s, especially. I liked learning more about Gertrude, but I did not appreciate or enjoy the way they constructed this documentary, and they're interjecting. I was like, I didn't know what was real, what was a recreated image or a recreated scene or video, piece of video versus what was supposed to be drawn, you know, from the archives and newsreel type footage.
Yeah, that's cut together. I don't think you're supposed to know exactly which black and white footage is real and which is fake.
But it bothered me to not know, and so I just didn't trust.
My smoke alarm's going off.
Is that
upstairs.
Your smoke alarm? I hope we're not burning down there, Charlie.
You know, but, it's because this podcast is so hot.
It is a hot podcast. It's smoking. I think her story is way more interesting and fascinating than this film is. And I completely disagree with you. I would say if you were only going to choose this documentary or Queen of the Desert, the Nicole Kidman dramatized version, I think you're going to appreciate, get a lot more out of who this woman was from watching the film, the dramatized Werner Herzog version, as opposed to this very, very, very slow, boring documentary.
I was going to let you off the hook. You know, I was like, I understand, you know, why you don't like this. And then you praised Herzog's film so much.
I didn't praise. No. I did not like
both of them. Stink.
No, they both are bad. Okay. Let me clarify. Gertrude Bell is more fascinating in reality, and read the biography. This is one of those rare cases where I would say go read the book. And then if you want to sort of supplement your knowledge with these films, great. Or if she piques your interest enough to drive you to, I think that's what I had said about that movie, about Queen of the Desert when it came out, was I just learned something. I learned about this person that I really did not know about. And she was this pioneer, you know, and just, it's a good character to know, a good woman to learn about, but neither one of these movies does her justice.
All right, our next film you didn't see, and it's one of those ones that I would almost, it reminds me of A Clockwork Orange. I would love to tie you down into a movie theater chair and bolt your eyelids open and make you watch this movie. It's called Manifesto, and it was also at this year's Sundance, and it's pretty much, it's the Cate Blanchett show. She plays 13 different characters in this movie. But movie. Is movie the right word for what this is? It's a concept art experiment.
Mm.
Everything said is drawn from, it's quoting a manifesto written by some 20th century artist or architect or filmmaker. And she's, you know, and they put her in different situations to talk about them. On one hand, she's a mom sitting down to the dinner table to say grace. There's her husband and three sons. And she launches into a manifesto about what art is for like a half hour. It's hysterical. And on another one, she's a newscaster talking to a live feed through another Cate Blanchett in a hurricane. She's like, Cate, if you can hear me, why is art and futurism and structuralism, blah, 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 blah. And it's fascinating to see, though, how they did it like that. It's an acquired taste. The first half, I almost shut it off. I complete movies. I am a completist. I do not turn off movies. And about the 42-minute point, I almost just couldn't do it. And I gave it a little bit longer. And by the end, then I just broke the code. I was like, okay, none of this is, it doesn't mean anything. She's just, they put her in these amusing situations to make light of art theory. And by the way, this is not for the casual movie fan. This is not for the serious movie fan. This is for art grad students. This is really art theory. By the end, she's instructing this, I don't know, second grade class about, we talked about the other week, about the Dogma 95 when we talked about the commune. You can only use natural light. There can be no outside influence. And she's instructing this to the second graders. It's from a man called Julian Roosevelt. It looks like it's his first film. It's audacious. It's gorgeous. It is gorgeous production and cinematography, but good Lord, it is so difficult to listen to.
Well, that sounds like one that I need to pass along to Artie Chick of chickflix.net to review, because I had absolutely no interest in seeing anything that was described as a concept art experience.
Yeah, it is. It's
generally
it's hard work.
If it's hard work, without the payoff, then I was so maxed out to begin with on movies from the past 10 days, I would say. And so this one, I just had no time left to try and squeeze in Manifesto and another art house film. But I would definitely throw it to Artie Chick to see if she, what her perspective might be on it, because she is, you know, an art history buff as well. So, you know, more power to you if you want
no one's
experimental
gonna see
film.
No one's
going to
see it.
The only reason that I would think anyone might find it or be intrigued is Cate Blanchett.
We're talking best actress material
here. She's a draw.
Here.
She's an absolute draw. So it's always fascinating to me when actors pick these projects. You know, you're like, what are they thinking?
And she dove into this challenge, this in-your-face experiment with both feet. Like, she played the game.
I'm sure from an artistic perspective as an actor, she was appreciating this opportunity. You know, then how does that compare to, like, Joseph Gordon-Levitt and his 9 personalities in whatever that other movie was that we saw a couple months ago where he plays the serial killer?
I have no idea what you're talking about.
Oh, come on.
I'm serious.
Wasn't it Joseph Gordon-Levitt who played, or am I getting him mixed up with some? I think I am getting him mixed up with someone else. The one with the multiple personality disorder.
Oh, you're just going to Split?
Split. Who was in Split? It wasn't Joseph Gordon-Levitt, was it?
No. It was James McAvoy.
Guy. James McAvoy. Sorry. So, yeah.
What are you talking about?
It's like, oh, no, James McAvoy in Split. And so where you just know that as an artist, they appreciate this opportunity to play multiple roles and play off of them. So, but that one had definitely a broader appeal. And so as good an actress as Cate Blanchett is, a high concept art movie, probably still will not make my bucket list.
Well, Hannah, this feels like such a downer episode. I saw 6 films and I did not like 5 of them. I only liked Band-Aid.
And I saw 5, and I would say it's Band-Aid edges out Megan Levy by just a smidge.
Just a downer week.
Because at least Megan Levy is a uplifting, inspiring attempt kind of movie. And Band-Aid, I think, too. Everything else, yeah, was just sort of not enjoyable at all.
Well, we're going to get our film next week. The AFI Documentary Film Festival here in D.C. starts next week, and I'm talking like 5 docs a day for like 4 days. I'm diving in, so it's going to hurt my mainstream viewing. I think Cars 3, I'll get Cars 3 in on Monday. But
right, we're missing a couple of big ones that are going to overlap.
Sorry, folks, I'm going to the film festival.
Yeah, I am too, so we have that opportunity for the big opening night of the film festival, and so that will dominate. So we'll have to see when we can squeeze in a Cinema Clash podcast on some of the other
releases. Do a special episode about our, you know, themes, highlights, and lowlights of the film festival. Maybe with Artie Chick again. Mm-hmm. But tell Artie Chick there's a barrier to entry. She has to watch Manifesto first.
Okay. In order to participate, in order to be a guest on special episode of Cinema Clash on the AFI Documentary Festival, you must first watch Manifesto. Right. Well, seems kind of cruel.
It is very cruel. I really don't want to do a wrap-up on this. I don't want to go over all these films that I just crapped all over.
That's right. Well, I think we sort of told people what the highlight was. Probably Band-Aid.
Yeah, all right. I do want to end on a note. I'm gonna take a leap. I think I have to buy the bottle of wine next week anyway, because you bought the business cards. We'll make it a bet. I'll say The Mummy edges out Wonder Woman.
Wait, now edges out Wonder Woman in its from last week?
This week.
Oh, we'll see.
Wonder Woman in its second week versus The Mummy in its first.
I'm not sure I'm willing to bet that, because I just want
There's
it.
A good chance Wonder Woman's going
to
walk away with
Wonder Woman
$70 million. Dollars. I mean...
I'm going to... Because it might be wishful thinking on my part, but I'm going to take the bet in an effort to cosmically make it so. So go see Wonder Woman so that I don't lose the bet, folks.
Go see Band-Aid and make yourself a better person. All right. On behalf of the Cinema Clash, thanks for listening. I'm Charlie Jewell.
I'm Hannah Buchdahl.
Thank you.
Take care.
Cinema Clash with Charlie and Hannah is presented twice each weekend on RadioSt.Pete.com at 5:15 Eastern on Saturday and 9:15 on Sunday mornings. Cinema Clash with Charlie Jewell of charliejewell.com and Hannah Buchdahl of chickflix.net. Listen again for Cinema Clash on RadioSt. Pete.com.